I'm all you poor workers, good news to you, I'll tell how the good old Union has come in here to dwell.
A battle in the heart of Alabama caught our attention. Coal miners in one community, they've been on strike now for months.
Working as long as 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, in some of the most dangerous conditions.
I really think that the labor movement is the single greatest force for democracy in the history of the United States.
The story of Alabama is a story of not just resilience, but of militancy.
I say no contract, you say no coal.
If we ain't all free, ain't none of us free.
You're listening to Alabama's only union talk radio show, The Valley Labor Report, with Adam Keller and Jacob Morrison.
Hello, Tennessee Valley. This is The Valley Labor Report. My name is Jacob Morrison, here with my co-host and fellow agitator, Adam Keller, and we are broadcasting live-ish. Online and on the radio from the heart of the Tennessee Valley, the Spice Radio Studio in Huntsville, Alabama. Today, SPLC staffers fight for their workplace to match their values. Bernie goes to bat for workers. It is Workers' Memorial Day and more on the program today. If you want to be part of the show, we've got a phone number. The line isn't open because this is a pre-tape, but you can always leave us a voicemail and we might answer it on the next program. That phone number is 844-899-TVLR. That is 844-899-8857. You can leave a voicemail anytime throughout the week on any topic. You can tell us a bad boss story, an organizing win. You can ask a question, anything like that. Give us a suggestion for a topic to cover. We'd like to hear all of it. If you haven't gotten enough of us by the time we wrap on the radio, or if you just want to see what we're up to throughout the week, then you can find us online. We're anywhere. You can find anything online, all at The Valley Labor Report. We're on Twitter, YouTube, Facebook, wherever you get your podcasts, all at The Valley Labor Report. Just a reminder, your support helps us stay on the air. Our largest single source of funding comes directly from our listeners. So if you want to become a sustaining member of the program, make a one-time donation, or buy our new hat, you can go to tvlr.fm or patreon.com/thevalleylaborreport. If you're a member of a union, then you should get your local to sponsor the show. Our local sponsors are also incredibly... our largest single source of funding comes from our listeners, but we absolutely couldn't do it without the local unions and organizations that sponsor us. They make it possible as well. And so if your local has an advertising budget or something like that, that would definitely help us out. So our first story today is about the SPLC. The Southern Poverty Law Center was founded in 1971 to ensure that the promise of the civil rights movement became a reality for everybody. In 2019, the staff of the Southern Poverty Law Center won union recognition by a vote of 142-45. The bargaining unit encompasses staffers across the 11 SPLC offices in five states: Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Washington, D.C. This was after the SPLC refused voluntary recognition of the staff union after they proved their majority with authorization cards. They began bargaining in November of 2020. They stage a one-day protest almost exactly 1 month ago about the SPLC's discriminatory implementation of their return-to-work policy. Black women are four times more likely to be denied telework and remote work opportunities than white women, and seven times more likely to be denied those opportunities than white men. They spoke to friend of the show, Maximilian Alvarez, on his podcast, Working People, about just that. Let's see what they had to say.
So management has broken our remote and telework out into three categories. A distant remote, which means you can move anywhere around the country, and management will cover all of your expenses if you have to come to the office. There's also a local remote designation. This designation has been awarded to pretty much the whole legal department, the whole comms department, some members of finance, and that designation is different from the district remote because in that the employee is responsible for the expenses if they have to come into the office, and they can move anywhere they want to. At least that's what management said in the beginning. they're trying to change course now, but the employee is responsible for their expenses. And then there's a telework designation, which has been awarded, oddly enough, to women of color. And that's that telework designation is they have to come into the office 3 days a week, 2 days where they get to work remotely. But as a last minute game changer, Margaret said, oh, you have to be here Tuesday and Wednesday. We're still in the middle of a pandemic. I thought we were trying to reduce the number of people in the building at one time. So we have three layers. So that first distant remote layer I mentioned, guess who's been awarded that level? All executives, all make six figures. And the company is paying for their expenses. Let me back that up. The donors are paying for their expenses. You move down to the next level, local remote, all line staff, attorneys, people in comms, but they're responsible for the expenses. Have you seen the gas prices recently? They're insane. Yet this organization is holding all the line staff responsible for all their travel, and they can move wherever they want, but they want them to fly in at a minute's notice with gas prices and airline prices through the roof. And then the telework designation you have for women and women of color. And that designation has the least flexibility and restricted. And then you have the other designation. You just come to work and we just watch you every day. So there are these different levels. And if you notice what I'm saying, the ones that have the most resources spend the least. Matter of fact, they spend the most of the donor money that comes into the organization, which they say they're so concerned about. At the bottom of the pool, the lowest paid workers incur the most expenses. They're already underpaid, but the organization is costing them even more money because now I have to get up, drive my car to this organization with the high gas prices, or I'm gonna force an employee from across the country to come into the office, fly into the state and come into the office. For what? The disparity goes on and on. It's not just racial or gender roles. We're also talking about paternalistic. We're talking about, you know, classism. The disparities go on and on and on. They're endless.
Yeah, so that's what workers at the SPLC are facing right now. That was a chat from a month ago. They staged a one-day demonstration in protest of those policies. So we wanted to follow up with them. We wanted to follow up on their chat with Max on Working People. So we brought another member of the union on to our show. Esteban Gill is a union steward with the SPLC union. Esteban, thanks so much for coming on the Valley Labor Report.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So let's just jump right into it. Y'all held an informational picket because of those discriminatory and unfair telework policies. How are we doing on that right now?
Well, I just looked at in preparing for this interview, I looked up some numbers, right? We've got 40 to 50,000 new COVID cases a day in the United States and 300 deaths a day in the United States. For many of us, we might be done with the pandemic, but as a society, this pandemic is not done with us. Many of our, and you know, Lisa covered it, you covered it already. Black women are four times more likely to be forced back into the office full time, or at least part time. Now, I'm working from the office 3 days a week, but that works for me. That's okay. I'm a single guy. I don't have kids who can't get vaccinated at home. I don't have elderly folks or sick folks that I take care of. Unfortunately, many of my colleagues do. And many of my colleagues are coming to work today with the fear that they're going to get sick or they're going to take sickness back to their loved ones. And that's why we were out on the streets last month. And unfortunately, we've won some flexibility now. Management's not as keen to force us in on specific days of the week. And we are preparing to counter in negotiations with a remote work policy that gives us flexibility. Flexibility is the future for people who are working in offices. As my comrade Lisa had said, this is the 21st century. There's no reason for people to be forced into a cubicle farm to get their jobs done. And it's just a part of our overall message here to the community, to SPLC, that you got to practice what you preach. SPLC's vision is as a catalyst, or mission is as a catalyst for racial justice in the South, working in partnership with communities to dismantle white supremacy, to strengthen intersectional movements and advance human rights for all. The vision is a world in which everyone can thrive and that the ideals of equity, justice, and liberation are a reality for all. And our point is that we cannot successfully do that externally if we're not doing that internally. And unfortunately, our management hasn't seen it that way. So that's why we are here talking to the community. We are out on the streets. We are in our workplace, letting the world know to call on SPLC to practice what they preach. This is an organization that has 500 to $600 million endowment. That's bigger than many colleges and universities. We pulled in over the last 2 years, working 100% remotely, $230 million in revenue. About $28 million in net income, so after expenses. And we're looking at a reality now that we've got executives at our organization who make 10, 12 times more than the lowest paid employee in a world where inflation is now coming up to 8.5%. Anybody out there who's organizing for higher wages, better working conditions, if you're not making a 9% pay raise this year, it's a pay cut, effectively. Mm-hmm.
Right. And that, so, you mentioned the disparity and, 10, 12 times is as much as the median workers is, that's a little bit better than some people have. But that's still a lot. And like Lisa mentioned on Max's program, those are the folks that are getting the most lenient and the most costly telework options, because they're being allowed to telework 100% from anywhere in the country, and then on the SPLC's dime, flying them in whenever they're needed in the office. Whereas the rest of everybody else, the folks down on the lower on the rung, they have more restrictive telework policies, and they're responsible for getting into the office themselves. I mean, it's ludicrous. It doesn't make any sense.
What we've learned in our struggle here at SPLC in the last 2 or 3 years since we unionized is that even folks, and I think people in the nonprofit industrial complex generally understand this, that even folks doing work trying to better society, a boss is a boss. And, I don't understand it. We haven't been able to see the logic in some of the arguments that we get at the bargaining table or from management. It is nonsensical. As far as we can tell, it's about control. It's about wanting to watch your workers. And, we're struggling to understand it too. We worked the last 2 years perfectly fine. Everybody working from home. Some of us really liked that. Some of us really didn't. Now I'm glad to be back in the office personally. But the issue and the demand is for flexibility. Right. What works for me doesn't work for everybody. And, it's easy to say, well, this isn't a big deal when, you're at your second house and you're making a lot of money.
Right.
But it's a big deal when you're making $35,000 to $40,000 a year. And now suddenly you've got to pay for gas every day again. Mm-hmm. You've got to worry about getting your kids or your grandparents sick.
Right. And bottom line, since that action a month ago, there's been some amount of flexibility, but not much. How much are we talking, or is that, is it just kind of on a case by case basis? If there's like a really pressing concern, then maybe there's some leniency, but there's been no official policy change.
Well, my advice to people out there organizing their own workplaces, is the same. Things are working on a case-by-case basis. We have a fairly vocal, strong, and organized union, so we go to bat for each other, both in a sense of sort of a service model, but also organizing. And we call out management when we see inequity. Some things have been addressed, but really we're gearing up for continuing to bargain. And the biggest thing that it did is that now management is inclined to talk more to get this contract resolved. We've been bargaining since November of 2020 for our very first contract, doing about 2 hours a week in bargaining. And now suddenly we're scheduling full days bargaining sessions because management knows that the community sees this and that they need to treat us fairly, and we need to get a contract racked up sooner rather than later.
Yeah, bargaining for a year and a half. I mentioned that since November of 2020. That is that's Looney Tunes for for an organization like the Southern Poverty Law Center. I mean, the United Launch Alliance here in Decatur, we've got a lot of knowledge on that, and because David, the current president of that local there, he was formerly the co-host on this program, and we're still really close, and we talk about them on the show a lot. ULA is not a friendly organization to its union, but I mean, even just for the just to get it over with, they set aside 4 weeks of bargaining right before the contract goes up. The contract expires in May the 1st. And so they set up April to bargain. They set up 4 weeks to bargain. They did it every day. And then, bam, they're done. They're done with bargaining now. Members are reviewing the contract, and they're going to vote on it. And why would the SPLC do anything different than that? I mean, what do you see as the reason for pulling out bargaining for a year and a half? I mean, it shouldn't take that long.
It absolutely shouldn't. We've been demanding more time for bargaining. We've been demanding more off time for union organizers to research proposals, to study things, to, you know, get feedback from our unit, to come up with counter proposals. You know, this last action, we believe, has done a lot to push us back to the table to increase bargaining time. And yeah, we would love 4 weeks set aside for us to sit down together 8 hours a day and figure it out. You know, we're lucky to organize with the Washington Baltimore News Guild, which is a traditionally a newspaper union, but they thoroughly believe in member democracy. So it's worker organizers doing the negotiating, making the decisions, interacting with our bargaining unit, not paid staff. This is what we do on our off time. You know, we meet Monday nights, we meet Tuesday nights, we meet Wednesday nights, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, like I said before, you know, this is a class struggle. And, you know, even within the nonprofit social justice sphere of things, management, especially upper management, occupy a class and have interests that are not in line with their workers. So, you know, and also these things are complicated. We, you know, this is many of us first time ever in a union, both for us and for management, right? And also we organized 2 months before the pandemic hit. So that's caused some delays as well. You know, trying to organize a union via Zoom is not optimal.
Right.
You know, here we are. Now we're making some noise out in public. We're coming to the community, and we hope that leads to more bargaining so we can wrap this contract up and get the best deal that we can, you know, out of an organization that has the resources to practice its values internally as well as externally and pay us all enough to thrive and hire enough of us to where we're not fueling this cycle of burnout that we have here at SPLC and in the nonprofit sector generally.
Right. When we spoke yesterday, while we're talking about bargaining, I wanted to talk about this. Open bargaining is something that we've talked about with some amount of frequency on the program, and you mentioned that y'all do that. Y'all's bargaining sessions are open, and this was pretty astounding to me. You said that every session you get 100-plus members watching out of your approximately 200-member bargaining unit. What does that do for your... Well, firstly, in Max's talk with Lisa and Katie, Lisa said that management is still trying to act like the union is just like a minority interest in the bargaining unit, which is bonkers to me because they're seeing 100 people in these bargaining sessions. I don't know how they have that opinion still, but what does having the open bargaining sessions and so many people actually seeing y'all bargain with management, what is that doing for your negotiating position?
Well, for one, it holds everybody accountable. It holds us as representatives of our fellow workers accountable to them. And it makes sure, and management knows that they're being watched. And also, I will say, management's intransigence at the bargaining table, they're our best recruiters. right? So folks who were on the fence about being active in the union, or folks who don't understand what unions do, they watch bargaining, they watch what we say as negotiators, and they watch what the bosses say as negotiators. And, you know, that gets them activated. It gets them upset when you know, bosses say
when they see what the boss thinks about them.
Feel undignified. Exactly. We wouldn't do it any other way. Our colleagues, I work with some of the best people I've ever worked with here at the center. And they are, you know, ready to throw down and ready to do what needs to be done to get the best contract possible. And open bargaining is, yes, I wouldn't do it any other way.
Yeah, that's awesome. The last thing that I wanted to ask, and Adam, I'll throw it to you if you have anything after this. But, you know, you talked about the nonprofit sector generally, and the nonprofit sector is, we've had a couple of guests on about that and the specific type of exploitation that nonprofit workers get, and how a lot of folks are starting to, for the first time, fight back against that. Can you talk a little to that?
Sure. The nonprofit industrial complex is an industrial complex. It's an industry. There's a lot of money in it. And there is a certain reliance on the fact that people who are trying to do this work are dedicated because they are fighting for a cause. We are fighting to better this world. Here at SPLC, you know, we're calling for economic justice. We're suing over prison conditions. We're investigating and suing hate groups and people who will do us and our community serious harm if they're allowed to do if they're allowed any more lenience to do what they're doing, right? So people love that work. They're driven to do this, both because we need to pay rent, but we want to see a better world. And this is across the field. People get burnt out. They're understaffed. They're working long hours. They're working unpaid hours. You know, that's what I hope folks listening on this, if you're at a nonprofit and you're tired and you're sick and tired of what's going on at your workplace, you know, the easy solution is to quit and find something else. And you can probably even go into the for-profit sector and make a lot more money. But the long-term solution to this is to organize your own workplace. It's easy to quit. It's very hard to organize, but in the long term, we're all better off as a sector and as a society if all of our nonprofits are organizing, are unionized, and are ready to fight for what they're worth.
Adam, you said you had a question?
Yeah, Esteban, first of all, I want to say thank you for your efforts, and really what you just said about the nonprofit industry very much resonates, and I'm sure resonates with some of our listeners. But I just wanted to, you know, on a personal note, tell us a little bit about the work that you do, and what has having a union and being there to start a union, as you mentioned very recently, what has that meant to you?
Well, I work in criminal justice reform as a program associate, so I do administrative, logistical, and research support for a legal team across the South. In terms of, I'm sorry, kind of had a multi-part question. So in terms of what unionizing has done for us as a workplace, it makes managers cross their, you know, cross your I's and dot your T's, but dot your I's and cross your T's and make sure that, you know, there's an understanding that people aren't alone. You know, they might make a mistake at work. They might be getting investigated for something. And, you know, the greatest, at least for my personal interaction with being a union organizer, is when somebody comes to me with a problem at work. And the first thing that you have to let them know, and the first thing that they feel, is you're not alone. There's going to be somebody at the other end of this phone for you. We can have lunch. We can talk it out. We can figure out what we can do to make things better. Either on a contractual grievance, you know, sort of bureaucratic way, or as an organization of workers in struggle, where we stand up for each other and pressure management to do the right thing. And I come from a labor family. I'm also, I see your IWW t-shirt. I'm a card-carrying IWW member as well. You know, and that really is the future, is one in which workers as a class organize and push back and, you know, and take the wealth that we deserve.
Fun fact, everybody involved in this project is an IWW member. So
nice.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, Esteban, I really appreciate your time. Thank you for the work that you do, both in the SPLC and the union. We really appreciate it, and let us know if we can do anything for you in the future, okay?
Absolutely. We'll be in touch.
All right. All right, folks, we're going to take a break really quick. Don't go anywhere, though, on the other side. We're going to be talking about Amazon finally getting some pushback on their illegal union busting. You're listening to the Valley Labor Report.
Hometown Action is a grassroots organization building a multiracial working class movement for racial, gender, economic, and environmental justice in Alabama's rural communities. We stand in solidarity with Alabama workers and are proud to support the Valley Labor Report's efforts to inform and build the Southern worker movement. Please visit hometownaction.org and follow our social media channels at Hometown Action to learn more about how you too can get involved to make the South a better place for all workers. Solidarity, y'all.
IBW 558 is like a great football team. You've got to have the aptitude, skills, and knowledge to outperform the competition. If you're a non-union electrician, now is the perfect time to get off the sideline and join our team. We have the absolute best wages and benefit package in North Alabama and Southern Tennessee. It's because our team stands together, bargains together, and our families benefit from it. With immediate openings, you have the opportunity to see why the IBW is the right choice.
Energy Alabama is a locally operated and membership-based nonprofit organization focused on advancing Alabama's clean energy future through education and advocacy. Many people in charge of infrastructure and building decisions simply don't know about how viable clean and renewable energy is. To that end, Energy Alabama has provided instruction to more than thousands of adults and tens of thousands of K-12 students across the state. We're working hard to build careers in clean energy and help everyday Alabamians save money on their utility bills. Learn more about our work and how you can join us at energyalabama.org.
Support for the Valley Labor Report comes from the International Federation of Professional and Technical Engineers Union. Learn more by visiting www.ifpte.org.
The attorneys at Maples, Tucker, and Jacobs have stood with the working people of Alabama for over 40 years, providing skilled legal representation for your workplace injury claims. When you are injured on the job, it can be a scary time. The attorneys at Maples, Tucker, and Jacobs have the experience to guide you through the process to make sure that you and your family are properly taken care of and your rights are protected. If you need help, call the attorneys at Maples, Tucker, and Jacobs at 855-617-9333 or visit online at www.mtnj.com. No representation is made that the quality of legal services provided is greater than the quality of legal services provided by other law firms.
Support for this program comes from the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 136, out of Central Alabama. Learn more at IBEW136.org.
Attention union members, membership organizations, podcasters, or anyone with a payment processing need. The future is here, and your organization needs to be prepared by working with Unionly. With Unionly, your union or organization can take payments on a mobile device, eliminating processing fees, giving you a better price than other payment processing methods, while at the same time supporting a union-friendly business with a specialized skill set to meet your needs. Your members will thank you when they pay their dues at their convenience without waiting in line to deposit cash or check. Start preparing for the future today by calling 206-595-8631 or visiting unionly.io.
I'm all you poor workers, good news to you, I'll tell how the good old union has come in here to dwell.
Labor creates all wealth should go to labor, and you are listening to the Valley Labor Report. My name is Jacob Morrison, and my co-host is Adam Keller. If you've got anything to add, you can give us a call. The phone number is 844-899-TVLR. We are not live today. This is a pre-tape, but we can take voicemails anytime, and we might play it on the next program. So just a reminder, that phone number is 844-899-8857. So it is well known that Amazon receives millions in subsidies and billions in contracts from the taxpayer every year. What is less well known is that all of these deals are subject to them obeying the law, and that includes labor law. And we're always coming to you with another story of how Amazon is flagrantly violating labor law in that respect. So last week we told y'all that the Amazon Labor Union which won the first ever union election at Amazon in the United States a few weeks ago at a Staten Island fulfillment center, and is now in the middle of another election at a Staten Island sortation center. The Amazon Labor Union is calling on lawmakers in New York and at the federal level to actually enforce the law. Law and order unionism. I could get used to that in a certain sense anyway. in Seth Goldstein's letter to New York Attorney General Letitia James, Seth Goldstein is Amazon Labor Union's pro bono attorney, Goldstein quotes the relevant passages in multiple programs that Amazon has taken advantage of in New York, saying that there are currently over 40 unfair labor practices charges pending before the NLRB, alleging that Amazon committed unfair labor practices at the Staten Island facility over the last 2 years. The most recent ULP was filed on April 8, 2022, alleging unlawful coercion of employees exercising their workplace rights. He says further, Amazon appears to have engaged in a campaign to deny workers the rights afforded to them by the National Labor Relations Act, and has been found to have retaliated against them at They have been found to have retaliated against at least one union organizer for exercising those rights, and thus we request you investigate Amazon's eligibility for tax credits. Now, while New York Attorney General James has not moved on this yet, others have. Let's throw up that graphic from Bernie. Bernie is saying, the time for talk is over. The time for action is now. Taxpayer dollars should not go to companies like Amazon and multi-billionaires like Jeff Bezos, who repeatedly break the law. That is some incredibly benign things that is pretty wild that we're having to say, and that is not just taken as a given. It's amazing. In a letter to President Joe Biden last week, Sanders said, "Last September, I was delighted to hear you state that you intend to be the most pro-union president leading the most pro-union administration in American history. One of the most effective ways for you to begin accomplishing this important goal would be to ensure that no corporation that is engaged in illegal anti-union activities receives a contract paid for by the taxpayers of the United States." That seems eminently reasonable. He continues, "As you will recall, during the presidential campaign, you promised to, quote, institute a multi-year federal debarment for all employers who illegally oppose unions, end quote, and to, quote, ensure federal contracts only go to employers who sign neutrality agreements, committing not to run anti-union campaigns. That campaign promise was exactly right. Today, I am asking you to fulfill that promise. The time has come to tell Amazon that if it wants another federal contract, it must obey the law." Eminently reasonable, I think.
Seems like it.
He reiterated this in remarks from the Senate floor a couple days later. Adam, let's play that clip.
"A letter to President Biden urging him to sign an executive order to prohibit companies like Amazon that have violated labor laws from receiving federal contracts paid for by the taxpayers of America. Let's be clear. Amazon has already been penalized more than $75 million for breaking federal discrimination and labor laws. To date, there are currently 59 unfair labor cases against Amazon pending at the National Labor Relations Board. It is my view that the time for talk is over. The time for action is now. Taxpayer dollars should not go to companies like Amazon and multi-billionaires like Jeff Bezos, who repeatedly break the law. No government, not the federal government, not the state government, and not the city government, should be handing out corporate welfare to union busters and labor law violators."
And there you have it. There you have it. Republicans claim to be for law and order, and they also claim to hate Amazon because it's woke or something.
Whatever that means.
I don't know. But so let's see if they do literally anything at all to push this along, that would be great. I don't care if it's spite driven. I don't care. I don't care. I don't care at all. They should just do something. Do literally anything to support these workers and to enforce the law. Let's see if their law and order rhetoric is only limited to poor people. That's what my gut tells me, but we'll see. We'll see. We'll be the first to tell you if any Republicans get on board with Bernie Sanders about this. In the next story, we've talked a lot about organizing and strategies for organizing your workplace. And, few steps in the process are more important than inoculation. What is inoculation? Inoculation is basic, and I think that this is a term that we're more familiar with in the pandemic than we ever have been. When you're thinking about it in terms of diseases, inoculation, a vaccine inoculates you against the actual disease by either giving you contact with a less serious form of the disease or by giving your body like a dead version of the virus, or in the case of the mRNA vaccines with the COVID, what they do is they basically tell your cells how to create the antibodies to fight COVID. And so these are all ways of inoculating your body against diseases. Well, in an organizing campaign, inoculation works in much the same way. You have to tell your when you're organizing your coworkers, when you're talking to them, trying to get them involved in the union, get them to become active in their union, inevitably, the boss is going to be against you. Almost invariably, your boss is going to be against you, and they are going to try almost invariably the same tactics. There are going to be very similar union-busting techniques across all manner of workplaces. There are going to be some differences, some different emphases in different workplaces, but a lot of it's going to be the same. It's going to be intimidation, it's going to be lying, and it's going to be retaliation. And so, when you're talking to your coworkers, let's say you get them involved in a union campaign, but you don't tell them to expect what's coming. They have no idea. They think they've always worked with their boss, and their boss has always been really nice to them. And so they think that, oh, well, you know, I'm organizing a union. My boss is going to be fine with it. He's not going to do anything. And then, boom, you're facing a reduction of hours, or you're facing a disciplinary hearing for the first time in your employment at the company. Or your boss is telling you lies about how, oh, if you unionize, you could actually lose benefits. And, you know, most people don't know much about how collective bargaining works. They don't know that there's just so little public knowledge about unionism and about collective bargaining and about what your boss is going to try to do to keep you from those things. So what do you have to do as an organizer, as somebody in your workplace who's trying to bring your coworkers in? You have to tell them what to expect. You have to give them a little dose of what the boss is going to give them, right? They need to know what to expect going into this thing. And that's what inoculation is. It's just telling people that, okay, when the boss knows what's going down, that we're a union, they're going to potentially cut your hours. That's happening at Starbucks across the country right now, illegally, in my opinion. They're cutting hours for workers, even in workplaces that are not unionizing, just in a wholesale retaliation against their entire workforce. At the same time as they're trying to bring out this this campaign to say like, oh, look at how much we're doing, while they're cutting hours for workers across the board. Or maybe, you know, you need to tell your coworkers that, okay, look, you're actually not going to lose anything in the collective bargaining process because you start from where you're at and then you bargain on top of that. It's actually illegal for your boss to try to punish you and try to take away things that you have currently as a punishment for unionizing. That's illegal. They can't do that. Further, even if it wasn't illegal, you only get a union contract if you vote for it. Why the hell would you vote for a pay cut? It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make any sense at all, right? But these are things that most people don't know. Most people don't know those things. And so you have to make sure that your coworkers are educated. And,
right.
And it's important because if you're not the first person to tell your coworkers what to expect, if your boss is, that's very difficult because first impressions are important. And if your boss says exactly the same thing that you said they would say, then it shows that you know what you're doing. It shows that the union that you're working with knows what they're doing.
Right. Yeah, if you show up to a captive audience meeting and you already know all the talking points, that is so much better than getting caught off guard by either the sweet talk or the lies or some mixture of both that you may get from management.
Right, right. So the Starbucks Workers United campaign, they are absolutely giving us a masterclass in inoculation. Sarah Mugel is a shift supervisor and member of Starbucks Workers United at the Hopewell Starbucks in Pennington, New Jersey. And she wrote for Labor Notes about how inoculation has helped baristas at her store as they face pressure from management. They inoculated their coworkers so well that management literally canceled their second scheduled anti-union captive audience meeting.
Nice.
That's amazing. She writes that after corporate failed spectacularly in the first captive audience meeting, they decided to cancel the second, saying that they had, quote, no new information to share with us. We haven't had any since, even though many of us have actually requested another, as we have plenty of information to share with them. That's just amazing. That is fantastic. Outstanding. No
yes.
notes. I mean, it's really, really cool. And she wrote about, and I would recommend y'all go read that and y'all further subscribe to Labor Notes and support them. Go to their conference in June. Really great outfit. Really great stuff. Basically like blogs from union members across the country are some of the things that they put out.
Trainings. Including trainings on topics like this in terms of inoculation and the early parts of an organizing campaign.
Right.
And everything, including, you know, grievances, how to file a grievance, what's a good one, what's a bad one. So, you know, if you're listening to this and you don't yet have a union, or you're a gig worker, you're unemployed, you're a student, and it doesn't seem practical right now, there's not a union, you know, in your horizon, one thing you can do right now is subscribe to Labor Notes. Even just subscribing to the email newsletter and following them online is a way to be connected to the movement and to sharpen your knowledge.
Right, right. Yeah, it is really, really good stuff. And she wrote about that captive audience meeting that went so poorly for management and so well for the workers in Labor Notes as well. So after throwing in the towel, on that failure, on the failure of captive audience meetings, they moved on to the next tactic in their book, which Sarah writes, Starbucks Corporate decided to skip to the next tactic, one-on-one meetings between one barista and a manager, sometimes multiple managers. The idea seemed to be that separating us would break our solidarity and make it easier to lie to us. But once again, they found that Hopewell baristas were ready to see through their lies, push back, and support each other. She writes further, for our first round of one-on-ones, these meetings were framed as, quote, reviewing our benefits. Basically, they intended to tell us how great our benefits are and that they could take them away. If you think about it, a manager said, you've got a venti cup full of benefits. She said condescendingly, to make room for more, you'd have to empty some out first, right? And see, here what she's doing is she's implicitly threatening to take away some of the things that they have, which is illegal. It is illegal to say that we're going to take away some of the benefits that you already have because you're unionizing. That's an unfair labor practice.
Right. And whose decision would that be? Because, again,
right,
the workers and the union are not going to propose a cut in benefits or a cut in pay.
It would be
only
the
company would. So it's
exactly.
Again, we see this time after time where the company tries to deflect their own priorities as if it's the fault of you as a worker organizing.
Right, right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And so the barista responded by asking point blank, Are you saying you'll take away my benefits? The manager saw her mistake and backed off with, no, of course not, and moved on. And this is, you know, it's one thing to be in a, which is already, I mean, being in a captive audience meeting, it's one thing to be in that situation and be able to kind of bounce things off of each other and play off of each other's energy and support and solidarity and words, right? It's one thing to be in that environment and engage in what is a collective action, pushing back against the lies and the deceptions and the threats from management in this big environment where you've got 20 people in the room at the same time. You know, there's a lot of confidence that can be had in numbers. But it's even more impressive that the baristas are still able to do that on their own. That's amazing. That's really goes to show how well they have been inoculated, how much they've been talking with each other, how much they've been... I mean, you know, these are just like normal people, right? This is not... Sarah's not a Workers United staffer. This barista is not a Workers United staffer. These are just baristas. I mean, you know, I say just baristas. That's all work has value. But what I'm saying is that they're not labor relations experts, right? These are not people that have dedicated years and years, even somebody like me, they aren't people that have dedicated almost half a decade to learning about this stuff. These are people who have just been in the movement for a few months, and they're already to this level where they can push back on what management is saying with total confidence in what they're saying and total confidence that their union, that their brothers and sisters are going to back them up. It's just so cool. So how did they accomplish that? Sarah writes that they didn't take into account the months of long hours we've worked together day after day, struggling together to successfully run a busy store with the few resources the company chooses to give us. In the nearly 3 years I've worked at Starbucks, the resourcefulness and teamwork I've seen in my coworkers have truly been staggering. And that speaks to the benefit that can come from actually knowing your coworkers. You know, a lot of it isn't even necessarily the inoculation that they've been doing with respect to the union. It's just been working together and trusting each other through like crazy shifts, you know, sitting together, shooting the breeze at 2 or 3 in the morning after your store closes, or 4 or 5 in the morning before your store opens. You know, stuff like that is really, really important in building solidarity.
I think, and you're right on, man. It gets back to building relationships and building relationships that are built on trust and solidarity and, you know, just having each other's backs. And I think there's so much in our world, in our society, and certainly in our economy and workplaces that is designed to prevent that. We are supposed to be acting individually. It's supposed to be a dog-eat-dog world. And the more we can work together and look out for one another, the more powerful we are. And, you know, something I've said on the show before, and I don't even know where it came from, is that solidarity is a social expression of love. It's love that we act out in society, in our workplaces. And I think there's something, not to be too preachy here, but there's something spiritual about that, about having each other's backs. And as you said, being in the trenches together, whatever your job may be, whether you're dealing with customers or you're outside working hard, working up a sweat, whatever job you may do, there is something just so powerful about the shared experiences you have, the shared interests you have, and the shared struggle that you're enduring together. And the more you come together, the more powerful you are. There is truly strength in numbers. And I think these workers at Starbucks are showing all of us how it can be done. And as you said, these are not experts. These are not people who went to school for this. They are rank and file workers, everyday people just like us, who've recognized the power they have in coming together.
Yeah, it is. It's really inspiring what these people are doing, what the people in the Amazon Labor Union are doing. It's amazing. It's amazing. They're doing Lots of good things. Lots of good things happening in the country.
And that's how change is going to come. And that's how change has always come in this country. It's from the bottom up. You know, of course, we talk about politics on this show. We interview legislators and political candidates on this show. But by all means, please go vote. You know, vote every 2 years, vote every 4 years, every election that you can vote in. But this is a prime example of how we can change our lives, how we can change our communities, and take our destinies into our own hands.
Mm-hmm. Yep, yep. So Workers' Memorial Day is today, the day that we recorded this taping of the show. But for you listening, it was last week. It was Thursday, May the 28th, April the 28th. Workers' Memorial Day takes place annually around the world on April 28th. It's an international day of remembrance and action for workers killed, disabled, injured, or made unwell by their work. Workers' Memorial Day is an opportunity to highlight the preventable nature of most workplace incidents and ill health, and to promote campaigns and union organization in the fight for improvements in workplace safety. The slogan for the day is "Remember the dead, fight for the living." And there's a book recently written about accidents on the job and in society, and how allotted and how, broadly speaking, it would be accurate to say that they're not accidents. They're decisions made by society to not prioritize the health of working people. And there was a really interesting, and I can't remember what the name of the book was, but the author was interviewed on the Majority Report, and she talked about how the graph of accidental deaths in the workplace and in society tracks with wealth inequality, which is really interesting, and how the more unequal our wealth is, the more likely that working people are going to die on the job and in society, because, you know, and that makes sense, because the more unequal we are as far as wealth is concerned, the more power that the wealthy are going to have over society, and the less power that working people are going to have over society, and so the less power that we have in decisions that affect our ability to not be dead. So I'm going to have to figure out if I can find that book and maybe interview the author on the show. But every year around this time, the AFL-CIO, which is the nation's largest federation of unions — it is not a union itself — releases its Death on the Job report. So I'm just going to read several statistics from this report. They gathered this data from fiscal year 2020. And in fiscal year 2020, 340 workers died each day from hazardous working conditions. In the United States, 350 people dying per day. That's a lot. 4,764 workers were killed on the job in the United States. An estimated 120,000 workers died from occupational diseases. The job fatality rate was 3.4 per 100,000 workers. The cost of job injuries and illnesses is enormous, estimated at $176 billion to $352 billion per year. And this is, you know, as I'm going over all of these statistics, So many of these are totally unnecessary. Like, they did not have to happen. And they wouldn't happen if we took safety more seriously, if workers were able to implement safer working conditions on their job. Because that's why union workplaces are so much more safe than non-union workplaces, is because we take our life seriously, right? A lot more seriously than the bosses do. Industries with the highest fatality rates in 2020 were agriculture, forestry, fishing, and hunting, with 21.5 per 100,000 workers. Transportation and warehousing, with 13.4 deaths per 100,000 workers. Mining, quarrying, and oil and gas extraction at 10.5 per 100,000 workers. Construction at 10.2 per 100,000 workers. And wholesale trade, 4.6 per 100,000 workers. Notice how law enforcement isn't in that list.
I did notice that.
That's just some food for thought. OSHA resources in FY 2021 are still too few to be a deterrent. There are only 1,719 inspectors. That's 755 federal and 964 state inspectors to inspect the 10.4 million workplaces under the Occupational Safety and Health Act. Under the jurisdiction of the Occupational Safety and Health Act. The number of OSHA inspectors is near its lowest number since the agency opened more than 50 years ago. That's lowest total number. That's not number of inspectors per worker. It is near its lowest total number in 50 years.
Wow.
What has the population like doubled in the last 50 years? I mean, it's insane. There is one inspector for every 81,000 workers. And the thing that's frustrating about this is that OSHA is a reason that losers on the radio, on right-wing talk radio, tell you that you don't need a union. It's the reason that your boss tells you you don't need a union. Oh, workers in the past secured OSHA. Oh, that will protect you. That'll protect you. OSHA will protect you. Give me a break.
And conveniently, though, while at the same time saying that out of the other side of their mouth, OSHA would be one of those onerous regulations,
of course,
that they face from the government. And of course, we hear lots of whining and crying from business folks, even small business folks who think that these government regulations such as OSHA, such as, you know, workers not dying on the job, are just too overwhelming and interfere with their profit seeking. These statistics are interesting because just this week, to go back to Amazon, OSHA's investigation regarding the tornado that hit the Amazon facility up in Illinois, I believe towards the end of last year. So OSHA determined there were at least three major errors there, three major flaws in the operations, which ultimately put people at risk. Mm-hmm. And the punishment was a letter from OSHA. That's it.
Yeah.
Not even a fine. No real requirements for change. So even when there is an inspection, there's
right.
no teeth. There's no teeth
no
to
teeth.
It.
No teeth at all. I mean, it's like these people are talking out of three sides of their mouth. I mean, on the one hand, they're saying you don't need a union because you've already won OSHA. And then on the other hand, they're saying we need to roll back what little safety regulations there are. And then on the third hand, they're saying you should secure your life for yourself and be an individual and whatever. When on the first hand, they were telling us to trust the government.
Right.
I mean, it's so bankrupt.
It's a bundle of contradictions.
It doesn't make sense. I don't understand how people can be capitalist bootlickers and conservatives in that sense. Like, it doesn't make any sense. You've got to do too many mental gymnastics. The report also said that penalties in fiscal year 2021 are still too weak, and we just talked about that. The average penalty for a serious violation was $4,460 for federal OSHA. The average penalty for a serious violation was $2,421 for OSHA state plans. The median penalty for killing a worker was $9,753. This is in a situation where OSHA has found that your negligent workplace practices killed a person. That's what all the evidence is there, and the findings have been determined. You killed a person. What's the fine? What's your punishment? Oh, $9,000, like a freaking used car. A freaking used car. That's what workers are worth to these people. Not to the OSHA investigators necessarily, but to the people who make the laws. And we're worth even less. We're worth even less to people on right-wing talk radio who want to roll it back. We're worth less than a used car. The median penalty for killing a worker was $5,825 for state OSHA plans. Only 115 worker deaths have been criminally prosecuted under the Occupational Safety and Health Act since 1970.
Wow.
100 deaths since 1970, and we have 300 workers dying on the job every single day. Every day in this country, 300 workers are dying. Every day in this country, thousands of people are dying from diseases that they got from the job, and we've only criminally prosecuted 100 cases. It's disgusting.
And compare that to how many people are criminally prosecuted for any number of crimes.
Right.
Every
right.
single day, from, you know, possession of marijuana to unpaid parking tickets and speeding tickets. You go down the list, all sorts of petty crimes, all sorts of behavior which shouldn't even be criminalized. And every day you see these people being arrested, their lives being changed for the worse.
Yeah.
And yet compare that to the response of how capital is treated when they kill people.
Yeah.
When their actions and inactions result in people losing their lives. That's families and communities that are affected forever.
Yeah. Kim Kelly wrote for The New Republic about Workers' Memorial Day. The title is The Grim New Relevance of Workers' Memorial Day. She writes, "Truly the best way to honor the workers who keep this country running is not to pay tribute to them after they're already dead and gone. It's to take care of them while they're still here." When Mother Jones said, "Pray for the dead and fight like hell for the living," she wasn't talking about hand claps or simpering news segments. She was talking about solidarity, supporting our fellow workers, beating back the bosses, and taking bread and planting roses. That's the attitude that we need to be taking as we head into May Day and as we bow our heads on Workers' Memorial Day. The working class needs to seize the future while we still have time to live it. And I mean, I can't think of any other way, any better way to wrap up the segment on Workers' Memorial Day. But speaking of May Day, though,
Sunday is May 1st.
Yeah,
that's May Day. And of course, May Day was an ancient day of festivities to celebrate the changing of the seasons. But here on this show, we know that since the late 19th century, May Day has been known around the world as International Workers' Day and Labor Day. All the way back in 1886 on May 1st, there was a general strike up in Chicago for the 8-hour workday. And on May 4th, the police moved to break up a public assembly in support of the strike, and an unidentified person threw a bomb. The police responded by firing on the crowd of workers and supporters. The event became known as the Haymarket Square Affair, and it led to the deaths of at least 4 civilians and at least 7 police officers, with at least 115 civilians and 60 police officers injured. 3 years later, in Paris, the Congress of the Second International, which was a coalition of socialist and labor parties, called for worker demonstrations on May 1st, 1890, to commemorate the spilled blood of labor activists at Chicago's Haymarket Square in their fight for the 8-hour workday. Every year since, labor unions and workers in countries across the world have held rallies, marches, strikes, and other actions on May 1st to honor the struggle of the working class. So while Labor Day in the U.S. was designated in September, those of us who know the history of the workers' struggle know that May 1st will always be the real day to celebrate our labor and the wealth it creates, the need to put people before profits, and the fight for a better world.
Yep.
So happy May Day, everybody. I hope you enjoy it. If you have an opportunity to have fellowship with your coworkers, take it. If you have an opportunity to attend an action, a demonstration, a union picnic, anything of the sort, that would be a good way to honor the holiday. And hey, if you have nothing else going on, kick back, open up a cold one, and watch Norma Rae.
Yeah.
Or Maid Juan, or, you know,
Harlan County, USA.
There you go.
Catch up and watch our back catalog.
Yeah, there you go. Listen to some interviews that we've done with some really just cool workers and organizers in places like Amazon, Wayne Farms, New York University, The Appeal, all kinds of really great people that we've had come through on this show. And, you know, May Day is a good time to reflect on how far we've come and how far we have left to go. And I really like what Kim put there in terms of fighting for this world while we still have the time, while we still have a future. Because we all know that we are running out of time to deal with the massive climate crisis that we face. And we know that inequality is at historic levels. We know that the world is in a very dangerous place. And it's up to all of us to connect with our fellow human beings and really work as a class of people with common interests to build a better future.
Yep. We've had a great show so far. We've talked to Esteban with the SPLC Union. We've talked about Workers' Memorial Day, some inoculation stuff. If you missed any of it, don't forget that we're on YouTube, Facebook, wherever you get your podcasts, and you can listen to the full show there or catch clips that interest you on YouTube. You can just search for The Valley Labor Report. We're going to take a really quick break and come back for our final segment. We're going to be talking to Kathleen Kirkpatrick about something interesting and relevant regarding the anti-riot bill. And we're going to be doing Last Week in Southern Labor and Getting Out of Here. So don't change the channel. You're listening to the Valley Labor Report, and we will be right back.
Energy Alabama supports consumers and is a leader in advocating for them. We have been able to successfully fight off utility rate increases in the state, reduce fees for electric vehicles, increase electric vehicle infrastructure spending, and secured a $100 million refund by Alabama Power after the utility overcharged customers for fuel. To learn more about our work advocating for customers and join the fight, go to energyalabama.org.
There's a lot of talk about a shortage of workers, but that's not the case with IBW 558. We have provided our customers over 3,000 workers and performed over 3 million man hours in a pandemic year. With 8,000 OJT hours, 900 classroom hours, OSHA 30, and a state license, our members receive the equivalent of a master's degree. That's what makes IBW 558 the right choice for your electrical needs. Look us up at Facebook or at IBW558.org.
North Alabama DSA is looking for folks to work for a better North Alabama. They prioritize mutual aid, municipal activism, and union solidarity. Contact them on social media or dsanorthalabama@gmail.com for more information.
Support for this program is provided by the International Association for Machinists and Aerospace Workers, Local Lodge 44 in Decatur, Alabama. Learn more at iamaw44.org.
Hometown Action is a grassroots organization building a multiracial, working-class movement for racial, gender, economic, and environmental justice in Alabama's rural communities. We stand in solidarity with Alabama workers and are proud to support the Valley Labor Report's efforts to inform and build the Southern worker movement. Please visit hometownaction.org and follow our social media channels at Hometown Action to learn more about how you too can get involved to make the South a better place for all workers. Solidarity, y'all.
Support for this program also comes from the Ironworkers, Local 477. So if you are looking for contractors with lower than average EMR and TRIR, they tell me that if you need to know what those mean, then you will. Or if you need to supplement a workforce at any level for any amount of time, short or long term, if you need ironworkers that come trained and certified at no extra cost, or if you need workers from superintendent down to general laborer and you're looking to start work on a project or you're unhappy with your current contractor situation, you need to call my friend Jeb Miles with the Ironworkers Local 477. They only work with the best in the business, vetted contractors, and can do all kinds of jobs from roofing to steel and bridge erection, from welding to heavy rigging, from structural repairs to machinery alignment, and much more. They supply manpower on 4 of the 5 largest projects in North Alabama, so you know they're legit. If you need good quality, safe, efficient, diligent, and knowledgeable workers on your job, then you need the Ironworkers Local 477. Call Jeb Miles at 256-383-3334 or via email at local477@bellsouth.net and make sure you tell them that you heard about them on the Valley Labor Report.
We're the nurses, firefighters, and claims representatives that help keep our government services running. We respond to natural disasters, we care for our nation's veterans, and we investigate discrimination in the workplace. We are federal and D.C. government workers, and we are proud to serve the American people. Working in more than 70 agencies across the government, we know we can fulfill our mission because our union has our back. Learn more at afge.org. Paid for by the American Federation of Government Employees, AFL-CIO.
Support for this program also comes from the Mid-South Council of Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Union. Learn more at rwdsu.info.
Alabama's only Union Talk Radio Show. This is the Valley Labor Report. My name is Jacob Morrison. My co-host is Adam Keller. If you've got anything to add, give us a call. Our phone line is not open because we're pre-taping this, but you can always leave us a voicemail and we might answer it on the next program. The phone number is 844-899-TVLR. Again, that phone number is 844-899-8857. And if you listen to the program as a podcast, you can leave us a voicemail anytime. Anytime. I know y'all don't usually listen to us live. So if you're listening to us, you know, 2 or 3 in the morning or whatever you're doing, you can just call. Let us know your thoughts. Give us a bad boss story, an organizing win. Give us a question, a topic suggestion. You name it. Whatever. We're up for everything. So we talked about the anti-riot bill in the legislature a lot this session. The legislative session ended a few weeks ago. And this was something that we talked about for several weeks, about how it would stifle speech, how it would stifle the assembly of workers and citizens, and how it would stifle the ability of workers and citizens to protest the state and their bosses. Well, there was an incident recently that underscores how this legislation would potentially impact communities differently. So we brought on Kathleen Kirkpatrick from Hometown Action to talk to us about it. Hometown Action is a sponsor of the program. Kathleen, thank you for talking to us.
No, I'm glad to be here.
So give us a debrief on this situation with Wetumpka that kind of sent your spidey senses tingling a little bit. Like, what? Give us a background on like what's going on there.
So, and this is my reading of what happened. I used to live in Wetumpka, so I still follow some activities in Wetumpka on social media. And over the weekend, I saw mention of some disagreements between the local softball leagues and the city over use of the city-owned softball and recreation facility. And people were so up in arms about the city shutting down the softball fields that they all appeared at what was not a public meeting, but a closed meeting between various organizations in the city at a city facility over the weekend. And like 300 people showed up. They were carrying signs. They were making enough noise to disturb the meeting inside. And then I saw that there was even mention of people being in the roadway as a method of demonstration. And then what really caught my eye was in an article, I believe it was in the Elmore Otoga News, which is in Elmore County. And this news article mentioned a quote from someone who said that they brought their kids because they felt it was important for them to have an opportunity to understand why it's important to be able to protest and that there aren't many opportunities for their children to learn this.
We actually pulled that quote. Adam, let's throw that graphic up. The quote is from Casey Williamson. He is, like a parent or something in Wetumpka. And he said, quote, "This is all about the kids. I brought my kids today because it is a great lesson for them to learn opportunities to protest do not come up often, and this is a chance for them to learn a civic lesson in having a peaceful protest to gain attention to a worthy cause. Casey is a softball coach and has kids playing in both softball and baseball. And, like, I mean, that sentiment is good, is fine, is valid, and I think praiseworthy, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's great. I mean, people are exercising their right to assemble. They're showing up to protest about things that they feel strongly about. And I do take issue with the comment that there aren't many opportunities to protest around here, because there are plenty. It's a matter of what issues, what decisions you may be passionate about, and whether or not you want to bring your kids. But I just found that remarkable, because under what was House Bill 2 in the 2022 Alabama legislative session, these activities could very easily have been determined by local law enforcement to constitute a riot, which would include a 24-hour hold for people who were accused of inciting a riot. And they could potentially be charged with a felony. Mm-hmm. So, you know, again, there have been plenty of opportunities to protest in Alabama. This is the first that I've seen in Wetumpka in recent years, to see that many people show up. And I get it. I mean, if my kid was playing on one of these softball teams and suddenly they weren't able to finish the season, I'd be incensed. You know, I'd be calling my local officials and having something to say about it. And I think it's great that people showed up to express their concerns and to demonstrate, to protest, to ensure people, you know, decision makers heard their concerns and try to affect that outcome. They probably, you know, a lot of the folks that showed up probably aren't even aware of this legislation that's been floating around. Mm-hmm. Many states in the country, it's not just Alabama. There were bills this year, I think 37 states, and some of those legislatures are still in session, and those decisions are still playing out. There was a bill that passed into law in Florida, for instance, and it's being litigated.
Right. Yeah, and you're not out in, like, left field with this. I mean, this isn't as far as, if this bill had passed and you had a properly motivated police force and a properly motivated DA, under a clear reading of the law, you could charge these people with a felony. You could arrest them. And even if you couldn't, even if you didn't have a DA that was willing to charge him with a felony, well, that wouldn't matter if you've got a properly motivated police force, because they could just throw him in the slammer for 24 hours under violation of that law, ostensibly, under an ostensible violation of that law, because that law prohibited blocking roadways. And this is, you know, I mean, the guy said it, this is a peaceful protest, but they blocked roadways, which is, you know, I mean, I think that's legitimate. I think people have a right to block roadways.
They were carrying signs. Yeah, their voices were elevated enough that it disrupted the meeting inside the facility. And, I mean, these are all things that we've expressed concern about in reading the draft legislation that's been introduced.
Right. Yeah, the you know, you've got people that are disrupting a closed meeting that's not open to the public. Mm-hmm. You could, I mean, there wasn't anything different than that happening when people were assaulted and arrested by the police here in Huntsville. Yep. People were just present, and that was enough to, there wasn't any damage to property. There wasn't anybody harmed. They just decided, the police decided that they didn't want them there. And so they started shooting them and arresting people. And so, you know, I do think that, you know, and you mentioned this on Facebook, that this was either an all-white or a mostly white crowd, and I think that, you know, I think reasonably we can say that even if the bill had passed, this particular group of people would not be affected. Probably.
Yeah, I wonder how this might have been different in Wetumpka had there been more participants in this protest who are people of color. Mm-hmm. You know, if this had been a protest about you know, an issue in local schools or a Confederate monument. Wetumpka, you know, Elmore County is right near the big Confederate cemetery. There are a lot of folks in the area who support those. I personally, you know, disagree with it, with the Confederate monuments, and think a lot of those need to come down and things need to change there. But if there had been more people of color participating in this protest, I really do wonder if it would have been considered as peaceful as most people perceived.
Right.
People potentially have been arrested for stepping in the roadway? Would they have brought their children to participate in a demonstration and a peaceful protest? I mean, the activities that they were doing, you know, protesting a decision about softball fields was very similar to what's been happening up in Etowah County with protests over an environmental issue in the mm-hmm. Coosa River. Up in the Gadsden area, there have been several protests over environmental issues. I think of a lot of protests about everything from Confederate monuments to issues in local schools, any number of situations. You know, obviously there were protests in Montgomery this year that have made a lot of news, advocating against passing the anti-trans bills, which ultimately did pass. I think there will continue to be protests about, you know, these hot topic subjects, and mm-hmm. we're in a midterm election year.
Right. And the bottom line is that these people deserve to have the right to protest without fear of violence and retribution and retaliation from the cops, from the state. And so do Black folks. So do people protesting environmental issues. So do people protesting on behalf of LGBTQ folks. So do people protesting against racism in our criminal justice system and in society at large. So do people protesting their workplace.
Yeah.
And so many people in those situations, they don't have that luxury, and they are harassed and they are retaliated against. And this law would have been one more tool in the state's toolbox and in the boss's toolbox to retaliate against people who don't like what they're doing.
Yeah, and I think it should be safe to bring your kids, to let mm-hmm. them at least observe and potentially participate in, if not civil disobedience, at least protests and speaking their mind. I mean, this is a key piece of civic engagement. When we look back at the history of protest and demonstration in Alabama, you know, a big one for me is the Voting Rights March from Selma to Montgomery. There were kids who participated in that march, and some of them are still with us today. And their stories are so powerful about how it really affected their lives and their educations as young people. I mean, think about the Children's March in Birmingham. So, I mean, it was really that comment about, you know, having a place to bring my kids and learn about protest and civic engagement that really grabbed me.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Because there are definitely, like you said, and that's a good point, there are opportunities like that all over the place. Yep. But he is right in that it's good for them to learn those lessons, but there are definitely opportunities all over the place. But the state makes those opportunities maybe a little bit less safe for children, unfortunately.
Right.
So
I would like for kids to have opportunities to see these things in person and not rely on inflammatory, you know, news reports about, mm-hmm. you know, everything from, you know, a riot in D.C. and an assault on the Capitol on January 6th to a protest that I was at in Washington, D.C. in October. It was very peaceful. I was there with a large group of Indigenous people. And the first photo that appeared in the Washington Post was one of people raising a barrier. And that happened for all of 30 seconds. It was not really part of our protest group. I mean, that's just one example of how what you can see, what so often we see wind up in the news, is not indicative of the larger group effort.
Right, right. Kathleen, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us. I appreciate it.
You're quite welcome. Yeah, we're so proud to be a sponsor of Valley Labor Report and appreciate y'all talking with us.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. Thanks. All right. Yeah, so let's go ahead and get to Last Week in Southern Labor. Last Week in Southern Labor is a segment that we do every week where we cover what happened the last week in the labor movement in the South. We get this information from Jonah Furman's newsletter, Who Gets the Bird? You can read what happened in the entirety of the labor movement across the United States in his Substack, whogetsthebird.substack.com. And let's just jump right into it. It was a relatively quiet week for Starbucks Workers United, with 285 workers at 11 stores filing for election, which in any other time would be massive, would be absolutely massive, including in New Orleans, Louisiana. 159 subcontracted janitors and maintenance workers who work at the VA facilities in San Juan, Ponce, and Mayagüez, Puerto Rico, are organizing with SEIU Local 1996. 125 production workers for PSSI in Waco, Texas, are unionizing with UFCW Local 540. And not to be beaten to the punch by the Workers United campaign in New York City that went public last week, 107 Apple Store workers in Atlanta have filed for an election with CWA as the big brand retail revolution rolls on.
Way to go, ATL.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. 35 workers for Ingert Plumbing and Heating in Knoxville, Tennessee, are joining UA Local 102 for staffers for FLOC in Dudley, North Carolina, which is the Farm Labor Organizing Committee, are forming a union themselves. Three maintenance workers at Suiza Dairy in Aguadilla, Puerto Rico, are joining the Centro General de Trabajadores, which is a union, obviously. Eight guards at One Constitution Square in D.C. are joining either SPFPA or the Fraternity of American Protective Officers. In election wins and losses, 10 workers at the General Hospital in Castanier, Puerto Rico, deadlocked 5-5 in two votes on whether to join 1199 SEIU. And workers at local water utility in Washington, D.C. Suburban Sanitary Commission have voted to unionize with the Teamsters, Local 730, under a new Maryland law. In strikes and bargaining updates, bargaining has begun between manufacturer Arconic and four steelworker locals, Local 105 in Davenport, Iowa, Local 115 in Lafayette, Indiana, and Local 309 in Alcoa, Tennessee, and Local 420A in Messina, New York. The contract covers around 3,000 workers and expires on May 15th. 1,000 mine workers are still on strike in Brookwood with no support from the political class in the state. And 300-some-odd machinists at ULA in Decatur, represented by the Machinist Union, are voting on their contract on May the 1st. And finally, in political news, AFL-CIO President Liz Shuler went on a New York Times podcast with Jane McAlevey and said a lot of things about the labor movement and the Democratic Party and why mainstream unions have failed to organize. And with that, that's going to be it for us on today's program. As we're wrapping up here on the radio, though, let's do a few plugs. The League of Women Voters has a environmental education series, The Climate Crisis in Alabama, Impacts and Renewable Energy Solutions. On Tuesday, May the 3rd, they'll be joined by Scott Duncan and Daniel Tate to talk about utilizing clean energy here in Alabama. Just a reminder that friend of the show, Maximilian Alvarez, has started The Art of Class War, which will be a regular segment that he does for Breaking Points with Crystal and Sagar on YouTube. Early bird registration for the Labor Notes Conference ends on May the 1st. The conference is June 17th. I think it's 14 to 17. This says 17 to 19, but I think it's 14 to 17. Somewhere in there in Chicago. Just one more reminder, you can leave us a voicemail, 844-899-TVLR, that is 844-899-8857. You can purchase your hats, become a one-time donor or a sustaining donor, all at our website, tvlr.fm. And let's not forget our UMWA sisters and brothers that are still on strike in Brookwood, our Machinist sisters and brothers in Decatur voting on a new contract, our Starbucks sisters and brothers organizing a union in Birmingham, and our RWDSU sisters and brothers fighting to build a union at Bessemer's Amazon warehouse, and all of our fellow workers fighting for a better world. That is it for us today on the radio. But if you find us online, you can stay tuned for Overtime. We have a really great conversation coming up with Joe Marshall. He is a former president of a steelworkers local in Courtland, Alabama, at the paper mill. It was a great conversation with somebody with a lot of experience in the movement. So I hope that you'll find us on YouTube and take a listen to that. Until next time, all power to the workers.
You'll find Overtime in your podcast feed on Thursday.